This is a Leaders In podcast. Leaders In brings wisdom and inspiration from the world's most admired leaders in video, podcast, and live event formats. Visit leadersin.com for more.
This week, we get to know the real Simon Sinek, why the why is so important and how it drives everything. Hear Simon's views on Donald Trump, and most importantly, what makes a real CEO.
His video, How Great Leaders Inspire Action, is the third most viewed on TED, which makes him a global celebrity. In fact, as of today, it has 26,076,817 views, and he is the author of Start With Why, Leaders Eat Last, and many new books coming up on the horizon. We are absolutely delighted and honoured to have him here with us today. Simon, welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Simon, what we normally do is we start with what we call a sort of a quick fire round, just to get to know our guest a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond some of the traditional presentations. So what is it you'd like to do in your spare time? Is it watching TED videos, for example?
I'm pretty active in the arts, actually.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of modern dance, so I sort of go see a lot and sort of work with a few little dance companies. Active photographer and sort of visiting galleries and museums a lot. So I'm sort of a bit of an arty, so
great.
That's where I spend a lot of my time.
Have you always spoken beautifully, fast and eloquently as you do, or is that something that sort of... Like in the playground, were you?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was younger, the thing I got in trouble for most frequently was to stop correcting adults.
Right.
So probably, yeah. I think out loud.
Yeah.
And when I was in school, I'm not very good at sort of book learning. I can't read something and take it in.
Yeah.
And I'm a great believer that the strategies we figure out when we're kids to overcome our infirmities become our strengths as adults.
Right.
So I had to learn to... talk to people, to go talk to my teachers, to ask for help, things like that, because otherwise I would never have gotten through school. So it probably was a skill honed as a survival instinct when I was younger that's now helped me as an adult.
As you say, you like to talk out loud. You
think out loud, yeah.
Think out loud, sorry. Yeah, talk out loud. I think everyone does that.
I think everybody does it.
But I imagine, does it take quite a lot of self-discipline, for example, to sit down and actually write these books? I mean... You're clearly an extrovert.
I'm not an extrovert. I'm actually an introvert.
All right.
It takes a lot of energy for me to speak and to spend time with lots of people.
Okay.
Where extroverts gain energy from all those things.
Yeah.
I was never a writer, nor did I ever sort of ever dreamed of being an author either.
Yeah.
So my writing style is best described as... days of guilt and self-loathing punctuated by hours of sheer brilliance. The problem is I never know when those hours are going to strike.
Yeah.
So it's usually a lot of me sitting at home feeling guilty that I'm not getting anything done.
Right.
I don't have the discipline to work from 9 to 5 or write 2,500 words a day.
No.
It's sort of a more chaotic experience.
Okay.
So highly stressful.
Yeah. Final question on this quick fire round. A colleague of mine was watching the TED video with you. He's watched it before, but he said, I bet nobody beats him in an argument. Is that true?
I can hold my own.
Yeah.
I like spirited debate.
Right.
I don't have to be right. I like to understand things.
Okay.
And so usually when I ask difficult questions or I push in a debate, it's because I'm trying to get to the meat of the answer.
Yeah.
And if that unnerves somebody, well, then unfortunately neither of us are going to learn. But
No, I
consider myself a student in all these things. Like, I don't even consider myself an expert in leadership or any of the stuff that I even write about.
Right.
I could consider myself a student.
Right.
And though my learning may be more advanced than some people,
I
show up every single day to see what I can learn.
But isn't that a trait of a great leader, is that they never say, finished, done, I'm a great leader. They're constantly learning.
Well, the best leaders that I've ever met don't consider themselves experts. They do. They are all sort of, they all believe there's room to grow. And no matter how senior or how advanced, they have this sort of... childlike curiosity.
Yeah.
They don't always agree with everything, but they want to hear people's ideas.
Yeah.
And they lean in,
right.
And they tend to ask a lot of questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Because you were trained as a barrister, or you
almost
City Law School.
Almost.
Okay. So you left.
I came to England thinking I was going to be a barrister.
Okay.
Did go to law school and dropped out of law school.
Yeah.
And went back to the States and had a whole marketing career.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, I ran away from the law.
Was it an awkward conversation with the parents at the time when you decided to go into advertising?
No, the awkward conversation was announcing that I wanted to drop out of law law school.
Yeah.
That was the awkward conversation.
That's right.
And they were in the States and I was here.
Yeah.
So they used every strategy to try and talk me out of my decision.
Okay.
From being nice to coercion to telling me what's what. And,
so in some ways, it's probably a good thing they're 3,000 miles away.
Probably.
Otherwise, they could have convinced you you'd be wearing a wig today.
Exactly right.
If we could just talk, Simon, about the TED video, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, that was back in 2009. And when you click on it, it was I think it was recorded at a TEDx. It's got the sort of it's got an Office Depot flip chart in the back. It's quite grainy.
Mm-hmm.
And considering it's the third most... Mm-hmm. Have they asked you to redo it, for example, or they lose its authenticity?
No, they've never asked me to redo it. And the thing that I love about it, it is proof, you know, when people panic that their PowerPoint doesn't work or the microphone breaks. I mean, in that video, the microphone breaks. They had to replace my microphone in the middle of the talk.
Yeah.
And I think it's proof that the style in which you present, are you connecting with your audience? And the content that you're presenting is vastly more important than any of the things that go around it.
Right.
And people obsess about all the wrong details.
Yeah.
That audience is only about 50 people.
Right.
So I never expected it would be or become what it's become.
Yeah.
I mean, I showed up to do a talk to 50 people that day.
Yeah.
And I like doing the flip chart because I offer a very human message.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to me to deliver a human message with some slick art-directed PowerPoint.
Mm.
So I've always done it that way, and I still prefer that.
It must have been quite incredible. How did you feel suddenly seeing, going back to that video and seeing that you've got, you know, not hundreds and not thousands, but millions? And
I mean, they put it on YouTube at first, and I'm definitely very lucky.
Mm.
You know, that TEDx came out at the time when TEDx was still pretty new.
Yeah.
Now there's like 25,000 and like 1,500 new talks a year or something, or, you know, 1,500 new events a year. I mean, the numbers is ridiculous. And I think if it came out today, it probably wouldn't have achieved what it's achieved.
Right.
So there's definitely an element of luck. Mm. But I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's sort of like winning a lottery, you know, you can't really, you know, like, ooh, that's good, you know, because I didn't do anything, you know. And I was lucky enough that it was popular on YouTube, and they decided to put it on TED.com.
Right.
Yeah.
And all great leaders or successful people always, at some point, are humble enough to say it was down to luck, but then they also worked hard. And I know that presentation was previously a one-hour presentation. You got it down to 18 minutes.
Yeah.
And so for the people who haven't watched that, and I'm so sorry, Simon.
That's all right.
In every dinner party you go to, you probably say, what was it about? So asking that annoying question for probably a few millionth time. For the people who haven't seen it, can you just give a one-minute message as to what that video, the essence of it?
Absolutely. I mean, I discovered that every single organization on the planet, even our own careers, always function on the same three levels. Why we do what we do, how we do it, and what we do. And it's based on the biology of human decision-making. Every single one of us knows what we do. It's the job we have. You know, we know that. Or if it's a company, it's the products they sell, the services they offer. Some can clearly articulate how they do things, the things that we think make us different or special or stand out from the crowd. But very few people or organizations can clearly articulate why they do what they do.
Mm.
And by why, I don't mean to make money, that's a result. By why, I mean what is your purpose, what is your cause, what is your belief?
Mm.
Why did you get out of bed this morning? You know, why does your company exist?
Yeah.
And why should anyone care?
Yeah.
And what I learned is all the great leaders, those with the capacity to inspire us, everything from Steve Jobs to Nelson Mandela, regardless of what they do, every single one of them starts with why. They always lead with their purpose. And like I said, it's based on the biology of human decision-making. So it's not even my opinion.
Yeah. You talk about a cathedral metaphor in the book.
Yeah.
Can you just elaborate on it?
Yeah. So it's the difference of what we give somebody to do and giving a task to do. If you imagine there's two bricklayers, if you ask one bricklayer, what do you do? He says, well, I'm building a wall. And so every single day of his life, he comes to work to build a wall. You know, at some point that gets tiring. And if you ask the other bricklayer, you know, what are you doing? He says, I'm building a cathedral. Now, what they're doing is exactly the same thing. They're both laying bricks upon a wall, except one has a sense that his work is contributing to something much larger than himself, something so large that there's lots of other people who have to contribute, versus just doing a task and coming in and performing that task, even if he does it well.
Yeah.
And what you tend to find is people that have a sense that their work is contributing to something larger, especially something that requires lots of people, tend to have a greater sense of purpose and fulfillment and joy in their work and in their lives.
Yeah. I bet that second bricklayer had less sick days.
Exactly. He had vastly fewer sick days because he loved coming to work.
That's right. So for an individual, and you say it works both as the individual layer and as the organizational layer. Mm-hmm. And a lot of leadership gurus or success gurus, Brian Tracy, Tom Peterson, they say you've got to find a passion or a love for what you do. Mm. But for people who are watching this video that might think, I get it, I'd love to be inspired by what I do, but on a personal level, not organizational level, but a personal level, and they just think, well, I haven't found it. Mm-hmm. I haven't just, I'm not that inspired. But then I've got my bills to pay, and those are real bills at the end of the month. What advice do you give them to find the...
Well, I think that, this is where the why came from for me, which was I had found myself in a position in my own life where I had lost my passion for what I was doing. And superficially, my life was good. I made a decent living. I had great clients. We did great work. But I didn't want to wake up and do it again. And so I was very embarrassed by that. And I kept that to myself. And, the problem with passion, people gave me the same stupid advice. Do what you love. Thank you. Thanks. Find your passion. Thank you. Like, what am I supposed to do with that advice?
Right.
And what I learned is that passion, like profit, is a result. When we commit ourselves to some higher purpose, some higher cause, passion is the result. When we work hard for something we don't believe in, it's called stress. When we work hard for something we do believe in, it's called passion. Passion is not the entry point, it's at the exit point. So the question is not to find your passion or find the thing you're passionate about. The question is, what do you believe? The question is, what are your ideals? What are your values? And where are the places in which those people or those organizations share your values, share your beliefs? Who is articulating a vision of a world that you would like to live in? Push yourself in those directions. Be around those people. Align yourself with those organizations. And what you will find is you show up every day with passion. Mm. So it's not a manufactured feeling.
Right.
It is the result of being around people who share your values, share your beliefs, who you feel have your back. You feel the psychological safety being in their company. It's called trust.
Mm.
And the result is, it's the same reason we love being with our friends.
Yeah.
Assuming that they're proper friends. It's the same thing.
Okay.
It's all the same thing.
So it's really about sort of going and finding something you feel a kindred spirit to. So would a lot of people listening to this think they should just go work in charity, or is that, can you do good in the private sector as well?
It has nothing to do with it. Charities are still profitable organizations. They just define profit by another metric. It's not money.
Yeah.
So if the charity is aligned to save kittens from trees, then I hope you're profitable. I hope you're saving lots of kittens from lots of trees. So it's just how you define the output.
Yeah.
And the output must be greater than the input.
Yeah.
And it's not a question, traditional for-profit companies tend to be very good at the structure part and not very good at the sort of purpose part, where charities tend to have purpose pretty well down pat. It's the structure part that they tend to struggle with. So it's not right or wrong. It's not good or bad. They could both do with learning from each other. So absolutely, it has nothing to do with going to work for a charity. I mean, you go work for Virgin, for example, at the holding company level, and many of their other companies. Virgin really does believe in taking care of people. Their internal policies really are very generous to their own employees. Flexible work hours, for example. And we know as customers of many of the Virgin products that they tend to put us first, and we can feel it.
Mm.
And the result is people really love working there because they feel like they're contributing to the lives of real human beings. Now, is that charity? No, that is a for-profit enterprise. But we have a joy doing business with them or working for them because there is a higher purpose.
Yeah.
It's not just sell.
Yeah.
There's something else there.
Yeah, so it's really sort of working out what is the value you bring to the customers, and then make sure the leaders at the top of the organization are driving that down. So it's not just about your day job; it's about what you're doing, the benefit, the solutions you're providing for the customers.
What you find is at the end of the day, what purpose means is this sort of ethereal idea. What purpose really means is prioritizing the wants, needs, and desires of other people sometimes before our own interests. It's like being a parent. Being a parent is the most purposeful thing you can do. It comes at great sacrifice. You spend your money on things you don't want to spend it on. You buy a people carrier. You don't get to buy that Lamborghini that you dreamed of having when you were younger. You know, you take very different kinds of holidays. The back seat of your car is a complete mess. You don't get to sleep. And what's it all worth? It's the joy of seeing this child rise up and become something even greater than you imagined for yourself. Well, mm-hmm. That's what leadership is. And there's nothing more purposeful than committing your life to seeing someone else grow. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to all the great leaders in the world and you say, was it worth it? Every single one of them will tell you stories of seeing someone else do something that they couldn't even have imagined. You know, great leaders sort of take this internal oath that they will continue to believe in you even when you don't believe in yourself.
Right.
You know? And that's fundamentally what purpose is. It's an act of service, which is a very human thing. As social animals, you know, if we commit ourselves to a life of selfish pursuits, then no one will trust us, and we will struggle to trust others, and we will probably die lonely and stressed out, and we may not last very long.
Yeah.
But when we commit ourselves to take care of those around us commit to taking care of us.
Yeah.
It's not a complicated equation.
That's right. Ken Blanchard, for example, he was talking about servant leadership, and one of your tweets on March 9th said there is an entire section in the bookshop called self-help. What we really need is a section called help others. Mm-hmm. You know, and the leaders that really get it are the ones that put others first. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Is that why you came up with the book title Leaders Eat Last?
That's correct. Okay. The title itself came from a conversation I had with a general in the United States Marine Corps. And we sat down and I asked him a simple question: what makes the Marines so good at what they do? And he answered simply, officers eat last. And if you visit any chow hall on any Marine base anywhere in the world, you will see them line up in rank order. Right. The most junior Marine eats first and the most senior Marine eats last. Now, if the general wants to go to the front of the queue and serve himself first, no one will question that. I mean, he's the general after all.
Yeah.
We wouldn't mind. But the fact that the general, even though he has that advantage, he has that perk, that he would sacrifice that advantage so that his men may eat before him, says something to the people that he aims to lead, that I prioritize your life before my interests, or I would sacrifice my perks so that you may be taken care of. And like a parent who feeds their children before they feed themselves, no one tells us to do that. It's not in any book, you know, it's just sort of instinct. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, and talking about that, you talk parents and role modeling. I know you give around 100 speeches a year plus. So you may not remember, but one of the TED Partners events, you were talking about how in an organization, if a leader at the top gets a phone call and says, you know, shush, pretend we're not here, then that's sending a.
Oh right. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes. So
you can say it better than me.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the point I was trying to make was that the leader sets the tone.
Yeah.
And so when we say we demand that everyone in our company be honest and tell the truth, right?
Yeah.
Seems simple enough. And people write those values on the walls of their companies, right? Honesty, right? There it is for all to see, you know, visions and values, you know? And the point I was trying to make is if the phone rings and your secretary answers and says, you know, David's on the phone, and you say, tell him I'm not here. That's a lie. That is a patent lie. And what we've now done is we've told our staff that when it suits us, it's okay to tell these little lies. Mm. So in an organization like that, it should come as no shock when people are lying in other parts of the company for self-interest, because that tone was set by the leader. Yeah. So you can say, I'll call him back. You know, you can say, I don't want to talk to him right now. But when you say, tell him I'm not here, when clearly you are, then that leader says that in our organization, lying is acceptable. That's what that is. Mm-hmm. So writing on the wall means nothing. The behavior that we model absolutely matters. You know, it's like parents today telling their kids to get off their cell phones, and then it's the father or the mother that are sitting at dinner on the cell phone.
In your book, you say, every single employee is somebody's son or somebody's daughter, like a parent and a leader of a company is responsible for their precious lives. But are you suggesting there should be no fire policies, there's no layoffs, or... you just struggle through the tough times?
Yeah. So that quote was said by a wonderful leader by the name of Bob Chapman.
Yeah.
And he's the one who, in his company, they believe in heart counts, not head counts.
Right.
Right? And I talked to so many CEOs who use layoffs on an annual basis.
Yeah.
And I asked them, why'd you do it? And they say to me, I had no choice. Really? None? No choice at all? you know. And it's not that they have no choice, it's that they chose an expedient route, or they didn't want to suffer a short-term sacrifice for the long-term gain. They took, you know, they wanted the short-term bump, or they didn't ask anybody what other options are there, because the amazing thing is there absolutely are options. Mm. And what we fail to consider is that many of the business practices that are considered normal today were actually pioneered in the 80s and 90s, right? So the concept of shareholder supremacy was a theory proposed in the late 1970s and popularized in the 1980s and 90s. The idea of using mass layoffs to balance the books, right? Mm. So we're going to use people to compensate for missing our arbitrary projections, right? Yeah. Did not exist prior to the 1980s. Just did not exist. Mm. Mass layoffs were used very sparingly, and really when it was the company was going under, and it was really a last-ditch resort. But to use the people on an annual or even quarterly basis simply to make the numbers work, and sometimes it's not even that. A few years ago, Citibank announced record-high layoffs the exact same year they announced record-high average bonuses. Figure that one out. Mm. Or companies that don't lose money have layoffs. Like, why is that happening? The point is these ideas were popularized in the 80s and 90s. The idea of Rankin Yank that you raised, that Jack Welch at GE pioneered and popularized, there were very different times. There were boom years. It was relative peace in the world. It was a kinder, gentler Cold War. And it was really about self-interest. And all of those theories were good for the short term. GE needed a $300 billion bailout in 2008 because the company wasn't built to survive for the long term, and it couldn't withstand the pressures of the stock market crash. Right. Had the government not intervened, they may not be a General Electric right now, and all of Jack Welch's theories would have been thrown out the window. So we are suffering the side effects of some really twisted business ideas that were pioneered in a different age, and that, quite frankly, no longer work today because the world is very, very different. Yeah. And so the companies that still embrace those ideas are the ones that are suffering engagement problems, where they're complaining that the people aren't engaged. Figure that one out, you know? Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are suffering very high churn, very low trust, very low loyalty, and the business is very hard and very stressful because they're always playing catch-up for the short term. Mm. So quite frankly, we need new business theories. We need to throw out these business theories from the 80s and 90s and reinstall theories where people come before numbers. And the joke is, it's actually better for business. Right. That's the joke. Companies that do that actually outperform their competition of the long term almost every single time. Yeah. That's the joke. It is good for the shareholder. It is good for the company. It is good for the stock price. That's the folly of all of this. Mm. But it's better for the long term.
And the reason why that is so important, I'm guessing, is because, first of all, you're loaded with purpose, which is, as you say, is the key thing. And then on the other side, if you've got purpose but you're feeling, I don't know, not safe, then I guess the safety is, in pecking order, sort of comes above the feeling of purpose. So you're just thinking, what's going to happen? I'm looking over my shoulder, you get paranoia
right.
setting in, and so, that spreads, right?
So if a company does embrace layoffs and redundancies to balance the books,
yeah.
you know, we missed our numbers this year, nothing personal, it's just business. Yeah. Unfortunately, business is unbelievably personal because 100% of employees are people, 100% of customers are people, 100% of shareholders are people. It is the most personal thing there is.
Yeah.
So we send a bunch of people home, forced to tell their spouses that they can no longer provide because the company missed their arbitrary projections, which is the equivalent of a coach prioritizing the needs of the fans over the needs of the players. That's what that is. But forget about the people who lost their jobs. Think about the people who kept their jobs. They have now been told, you know, because every decision a company makes is a piece of communication, right? They have now been told through this decision that this is not a meritocracy. It doesn't matter how hard you work. It doesn't matter how many years you've worked and how many years you've sacrificed for us. If we miss our numbers, which may be no fault of yours, your job is on the line.
Right.
So what kind of culture do you think that breeds inside that organization? Those people are going to come to work and they're now told, give us your best. Rubbish. How about keep my walls high, keep my head down, not do anything that makes me stand out, because there's this element of psychological fear, there's this lack of psychological safety, that I fear my own leaders and I fear my own company, right? And so we don't take risks because if we make mistakes, what does that do for us? We don't innovate. And here's the truth of innovation. Innovation requires failure. It requires experimentation. So to innovate, you have to try and you have to fail. That is inherent in innovation. So companies talk about how we want to be innovative and then have systems and policies like this. It's actually counterintuitive and counterproductive.
Yeah.
So it is unbelievably destructive, yeah, not only to the company, but also to the people who work within that company, to build a culture where we fear each other.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be like some chap running around with a knife. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm sort of this slow drip. Like, and then I don't really trust the people I work for. I can't really rely on my colleagues. Sure, there's one or two that I really like and trust. But in general, I don't believe that there's a culture of trust here where we'll all look after each other. So there's drip, drip, drip. And this is what contributes to the stress we have at work. This is what work-life imbalance means. It has nothing to do with how much yoga we do. It means I feel safe at home, but I don't feel safe at work. And that's the imbalance. And that's what causes unbelievable stress and heart disease and cancer and diabetes and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Just quickly to clarify this section of the interview, what you're saying there is layoffs are not a good business strategy. But obviously, if somebody is not living and breathing the values of the organization, they're underperforming and they're not profitable and they don't care, those people don't.
Yeah, I don't have any issue with that. So I'm not against getting rid of people.
No.
But the question is, A, for what reason are we getting rid of them? And B, how are we getting rid of them?
Yeah.
So if somebody has a performance problem, the immediate reaction is not sack them, right? We all have performance issues, all of us, throughout our careers. The question is why? And so what good leaders do is they embody empathy. So you don't walk into someone's office and say, you know, your numbers are down for the third time in a row. If you don't pick up your numbers, there's nothing I can do to guarantee your job is safe. How hard do you think that person's going to work? That's panic. Right? As opposed to going into their office and saying, your numbers are down for the third time in a row. Are you okay? What's going on? Is everything all right? You know, there's a very different reality there. An active member of the U.S. Navy SEALs told me something, which I found remarkable. He says, when they're evaluating if guys are going to get onto SEAL Team 6, for example, which is the best of the best, they look in two axes, performance and honesty, right? Performance and trust. Clearly, nobody wants the person who's a low performer with low trust, clearly. Clearly, everybody wants the high performer with high trust, clearly. What they learned is that this person here, the high performer with low trust, is a toxic leader. They would rather have a medium performer of high trust, sometimes even a low performer of high trust, it's a relative scale, over the high performer of low trust. Now, the problem is in business, we have a million metrics to measure someone's performance, and we have negligible or no metrics to measure the trustworthiness of someone. And so what we do is we promote people who are very high performers that are absolutely destructive and toxic to the rest of the organization. And again, that sends a message to everybody that it doesn't matter if you lie, cheat, and steal. As long as you make your numbers, you're safe. And so those people are the ones I'm interested in. If we take those people aside, find out what's going on, try to coach them, find out they're uncoachable, and then we sack those people, it sends a message to the rest of the company that says, no matter how good your numbers, if you mistreat people and you're a toxic genius, as a friend of mine calls them, if you're toxic to the rest of us, you're not safe here. And that means we all take care of each other because that's the standard that's set. But the problem in most companies today is we don't even know how to measure the trustworthiness of someone, and so we don't even consider it. It's not that we don't think it's important. We're just not measuring it.
Right.
And so we promote performance only. And we sack performance only, not considering that there are other factors that makes a company successful.
Yeah. In Tony Say's book, Zappos, he basically talks about how you've got to measure for the values of your organization and make sure that there is not just numbers.
Yeah.
It's how are we doing on innovation, helping others, and all the things that you've mentioned. I think it's absolutely spot on. I suppose, as you say, if you see your leader fighting for you, going in and being empathetic and listening, then you're going to trust and want to work for that leader a heck of a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, a father or a mother figure would do that. They wouldn't.
And Tony's a great example. He's down to earth. He's pretty low key.
Yeah.
He wanders around and he considers himself an equal amongst his people. And he's grateful to his people and he's generous and he doesn't put himself on a high floor with, you know, security guards and, you know, locked lifts and things like that.
Mm.
He's one of the people. And the company feels that way, and the results speak for themselves.
You're listening to a Leaders In podcast. For more inspiration, visit leadersin.com and connect with us on our social media channels.
We were talking just before this interview about how, you know, a lot of the great names, the, you know, the CEOs, the biggest companies of the world, the famous entrepreneurs, we've interviewed McChrystal from the US, you know, they all seem so down to earth, and they all seem just so authentic and, and themselves, comfortable in their own skin, and just relatively nice people. Now, and quite laid back. Are those the characteristics that have got them there, or have they got to that very lofty position and then relaxed because they've made it?
I find that the best leaders tend to be the best followers, right? In other words, it's the reason they achieved rank is because they saw themselves in service to something greater than themselves, whether it was a cause, whether it was some vision, whether it was their people. They saw themselves in service. In other words, they saw themselves as following, right? And that's what earned them trust of both those above and below them. And so I think that they tend to have a sort of this really sort of calm about them, because they are immensely grateful for the position that they have anyway, and they never expected to have it. And so every rank they've ever had, every level they've ever reached, they thought that this was it. So there's this immense sort of like, if nothing else happens, I'm so grateful. And they tend to, as you said, they don't seem to have much to prove. They're okay with how things are going, and they're eager to learn. There's a humility.
Yeah.
There's definitely a humility. And the best definition of humility I ever heard was by Bob Gaylor, who was the 5th Chief Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force. And he said, don't confuse humility with meekness. He said, humility is being open to the ideas of others. Mm. You can still have a big bombastic, you can still have a huge ego. And I've met some guys with huge egos, but when you say, I've got an idea, they go, go on. And I think that's humility.
Right.
It's not, oh, shucks, you know, that's that's meekness, you know,
which
can be faked as well.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Yeah, because you can be, as you say, humble, but also ruthless. If you're loaded with a why, where you want to get
stubborn
to.
Stubborn more than
stubborn,
ruthless.
Sorry, that's the right word.
Yeah.
Stubborn about where you're trying to get to, and that's important. But I, like everybody, I was watching some of your interviews trying to find, you know, Simon's top 5 attributes of leadership, and you said, you don't like that. You know, you think courage is the only thing that's common to them all. And like you said at the beginning, you know, you said you're an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Terry Leahy, who ran an organization of 300,000 people at Tesco, one of the best CEOs we've had in this country, is a self-proclaimed introvert.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, they're all different styles that get to the top.
Yeah.
Courage is...
For me, it is. I mean, I get the question a lot, sort of, what are the top 5 attributes a leader needs to have? You know, vision, charisma, you know? I know some really spectacular leaders who don't have big Steve Jobsian, Richard Branson-y visions, and yet they really take care of their people and are really pretty great leaders. And I know some leaders that really don't have much charisma. They're sort of weirdly quiet and meek and yet really brilliant, spectacular and loved, and you know, but I am comfortable saying that all the great leaders that I've met or looked at, they do have courage, and the reason is the pressures of leadership are overwhelming. I mean, we can't imagine the pressures of leading a public company or pioneering some political movement. I mean, the pressures are overwhelming. And the courage to stand up to the majority, the courage to stand up to political or financial pressures, the courage to not do what's expedient in the short term in order to do something that's right for the long term, is tremendous. The courage to speak truth to power, the courage to do the right thing, the courage to take a short-term loss in order for long-term gain. I mean, I can't imagine some of the stresses that some of these guys must go through.
Yeah.
And so courage for me is it. Courage for me is it. Yeah. And I think a lot of people rising through the ranks doesn't make you a leader. It just means you've accumulated rank and authority.
Right.
Leadership is something entirely different.
Mm.
There are many people who reach the highest levels of companies who are not leaders. They have authority, and we do as they tell us because they have authority over us, but we wouldn't follow them. You know, and yet we all know many people in the organization who have no authority, and yet they've made the choice to look after the person to the left and look after the person to the right, and we would follow them anywhere.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, those choices are hard, which is why I think when CEOs tell me I had no choice, my reaction is you just lack the courage to make hard choices.
Right. and making those unpopular decisions. As you said, even if you're the only one that thinks it needs to go that way, and the majority thinks it needs to go the other way, but you're the leader, you have to have that.
Probably need to have at least one ally.
Right. Yeah.
And if you're the only one, it could be delusion.
Yeah. You get your wife on side. Your husband on side. Yeah.
A couple people, I think,
would be useful.
Because you need to have a couple people to watch your back. Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the greatest leaders. Obviously, I know you're a fan of Apple. Clearly, a fan of Apple and Steve Jobs.
Yep.
And also Nelson Mandela. You grew up part of your time in South Africa, so I'm sure that had an influence on you. But those two are no longer with us. Is there any other leader that you think out there right now that is just kicking it when it comes to start with why or sort of embody some of your notion of...
Yeah, I think Pope Francis is pretty spectacular.
Okay.
I mean, he stands for something that's bigger than the church and religion, right? Yeah. He's accumulated popularity and a following outside of the Catholic Church. He stands up to the pressures, he sticks to his guns, and he's about inclusion and belonging, that he's using the church to advance, but it's not even about Catholicism. It's actually some even higher law, you know? And we can see the difference between the popularity he has versus the previous pope is amazing. I think he's a really great leader. I think he's an example of a great leader. I think Lady Gaga, for many years, was a great leader. She stands for something positive. She stands for inclusion. She stands for giving a voice to the misfits. She calls them my little monsters. You know, they even have a title for themselves. And she's unbelievably consistent. And, you know, when you see her, when she makes comments at concerts, she talks about inclusion. I was watching a press conference she did where there was MAC makeup, for which she's a spokesperson, announced a new color lipstick and she was going to make a speech. And I thought, how is this going to work, you know? And she talked about how she was very specific at picking a color that you could wear if you were black or white or whatever color you were, that this lipstick would work for you. And I thought, my goodness, even with lipstick, she's about inclusion, you know? And she gives people a sense of belonging. I like that. There's some of the great, I think, some of the great modern visionaries today. I think Elon Musk is up there. I think Richard Branson is up there. I think Joe Gebbia from Airbnb. He's got this very fast-growing tech company. It's only been around 8 years, and it looks like a tech company. But when you talk to Joe, he thinks it's a company all about trust. It's very human to him. I love that. Mm. I love that. So we have some examples, but we need more, and we need younger ones. You know, some of the people I'm talking about are old men, or they're retired, or they're dead.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's right.
And we are desperately lacking in a new generation of leaders, and we're desperately lacking in good political leaders, and corporate leaders.
Isn't your next book a younger age group, 6 to 12?
There's a few things I'm working on. One of which is an edition of Start with Why for 12 to 16 year olds.
12 to 16,
I'm really excited to write, because to give a younger generation a sense of what it means to.
Yeah.
Have a sense of purpose and live your life for a reason, and commit yourself to that at a younger age, and to understand the value of each other.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, it's so clear that you've got a massive, you're living and breathing why. You're doing this interview for free, and we thank you for that. But before this interview, you were talking about how
do others get paid?
Well, yeah, I shouldn't have said that.
Make a note.
Yeah, make a note. Oh my God, can we edit this out? don't send this to anyone. but before this interview, you just said you want to speak to as many people as you possibly can about sharing your message
and
try to inspire and enlighten people from within. It's quite amazing. If we can talk something current going on in the US at the moment that over here we just don't quite understand in Britain, and that is the rise of Trump.
Yeah.
Doesn't really personify you know, when I read your works and listen to your videos, I don't think equals Trump.
Yeah.
What
happened?
What's happened?
How did we get there?
Yeah.
So I have two thoughts. First is Trump is the result of a, call it, 8 to 10 year plus campaign by the Republican Party of harping away at outsiders are good, insiders are bad. As a party of no, they committed. I mean, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said very publicly that the purpose of the Republican Party, the platform of the Republican Party, is to deny the president any wins. I mean, that's not a platform, to be anti a person versus for the people. So for 8 years, they've been harping on and on and on about being against things, being against a person, and fermenting fear, all for short-term gains. Well, guess what? They've created an environment where the most anti, the most fear-mongering, the most outsider personality as a platform to rise. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that they had so many candidates all vying with their own egos that it spread all the votes around. So all the moderates were basically had their votes spread around where the extremists sort of could rise up because there were fewer of them. So they have themselves to blame for that. The other part of it is I think we as a nation need to take some responsibility. You know, I tend to believe that our politicians are a reflection of who we are. Our politicians reflect our nation. And this is as true for Britain as it is for the United States. We kind of get the politicians we deserve, right. You know? And maybe we're the ones that could be a little more cooperative. And maybe our nation could be a little less anti and a little less negative. And if you look at the state of the nation right now, black versus white, red states versus blue states, Republicans versus Democrats, Labor versus management, it's really the worst it's ever been. And maybe our politicians are forcing us to hold up a mirror and take a very hard look at ourselves and saying, we've kind of done this. We're the ones that have built this environment. Yeah. And maybe we're getting what we deserve. Yeah. So I think before we start casting stones, I think we need to take a very hard look at ourselves and sort of accept some responsibility.
Yeah.
And maybe be embarrassed and say, what can I change in my life or the way I lead my company that would deserve different kinds of leaders?
Yeah. Yeah, because that might have been the lingering damage of 9/11. Obviously, a lot of damage was done on 9/11. But if the population's got fear, and Donald Trump's mentioned, you know, Muslims, all this type of thing, maybe it's playing on that anxiety and fear. And as you said, that's not a good motivator. Carrots are better than sticks. It's interesting, you actually wrote on your blog, Start With Why, you said that Donald Trump has little viable policy ideas to back up his fear. Stoking is... irrelevant. As a PR expert explained to me, people don't listen to television, they watch it.
That's correct.
Donald Trump is pretty fantastic to watch. Dangerous, isn't it, in democracy?
He is pretty great to watch.
Yeah.
He is pretty great to watch.
He's done well on The Apprentice. And that's the danger, I guess, with democracy sometimes, is the fact that people vote in people for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the famous Nixon-Kennedy debate, which is the very first televised debate in the United States, is often called upon by political historians to show the power of television, because everyone who listened to the debate on the radio thought Nixon had it, but anybody who watched it gave it to Kennedy because Nixon looked nervous and he had this famous bead of sweat that rolled down his face, but Kennedy was confident and dry, and Kennedy in large part won the election thanks to television.
Yeah.
Well, since the introduction of television in the United States in politics, we've only had two presidents that were under 6 feet tall. Jimmy Carter is 5 foot 9.5, and George W. Bush is 5 foot 11.5, so just shy. In other words, imposing figures on television. And, you know, the moderates, if you look at Kasich or Lindsey Graham, just were rubbish on television. They had no personalities, where Trump is pretty fantastic on TV. In fact, all the telegenic ones are the ones that seem to be doing better. So we can't dismiss the television or screen-based way in which politics exists today as part of the reason. Yeah. And the other reason is, I think, in the United States, we're so fed up with all politicians. We're so fed up with their infighting. We're so fed up with their inability to get anything done. We're so fed up with them putting themselves before us that it's not that we like Donald Trump for who he is. It's that people like Donald Trump for who he's not. Because he's not like the politicians. And it's a bit of a vote against the incumbency rather than for him, I think.
You were born in Wimbledon, so you can't solve the problem and start running
ever want to run for political office in the United States.
Why do you think people do that? Why do you think Trump... I mean, Trump's got more money than, you know... It's interesting that he's... Berlusconi in Italy is the same thing. Is it just a power thing, in your opinion?
No, Trump has always been a laughingstock. He's not been taken very seriously by the establishment. And I think his run for president, which he tried a few years ago, you know, he tried the last time. He tried for governor of New York as well. It's his own ego, his desire to be taken seriously. Yeah. And I don't think he ever expected to get this far, quite frankly. I think he decided to run for president just to legitimize himself and be taken seriously by the establishment, because he wasn't satisfied just making tons of money.
Maybe he was something scared of his own heights then.
So I don't think he expected to get this far, quite frankly.
No.
And I'm not sure he knows what to do with it.
No.
Because it wasn't in the cards.
Yeah.
Wasn't in the plan, anyway.
We're just going to wrap up this interview very, very soon, but we started with a quick fire round to get to know you a little bit more personally, just in case I've missed some of the key questions, because you've been fantastic in this. Just a few quick questions. We've talked about courage, how important courage is. Mm-hmm. Is there so just quick questions, quick answers. Is there an ability to build up courage, or are you born with it?
Oh, of course you can build courage. I mean, I don't believe courage is an internal thing. I believe courage comes from the outside. Like, you don't dig down deep inside and find the courage. I think that's nonsense. I think courage comes from when someone in our lives believes in us. I believe in you. When someone is confident in us, you can do this. When someone's watching our back, when we trust that someone is there to take care of us, I'm here for you, don't worry. Even when you stop believing in yourself, I'll continue to believe in you. That's what gives us courage. Courage comes from the people around us. Which is why devoting ourselves to the service of others, true leadership, is actually a courage-building activity, because then those people are there to take care of us, which only gives us more courage to do more difficult things.
Yeah.
So absolutely, it's learnable. It doesn't happen overnight. It is a process. It is a journey like so many other things. And we build courage when there are people around us who care about us. That's when we have courage.
Beautiful. So it's the environment, and as you said.
100%.
Second out of the five... Public speaking, you're the guy that's got 26 million, whatever it is, on TED. A minute on public speaking,
sure.
The art and science.
Yeah. So I have one very important rule about speaking publicly, which is you have to show up to give. You have to show up to give. And I will very often, before I walk out on a stage, say to myself out loud, you're here to give, right? There's something I know, or there's something I've seen, or there's something I've discovered that others think is valuable, and I'm here to share it. And I want nothing in return. And it's unbelievable to me how many people show up to take. And you can see it. It's quite clear. You know, when somebody asks a question and they say, you can get the answer in my book. Well, you know the answer. You wrote the book. Why don't you just answer the question? As opposed to trying to get book sales, you know? Or people who, you know, you look at their PowerPoint behind them and on every single slide it has their email, it has their website, it has their Twitter handle, it has their Facebook, it has their LinkedIn. They want something from you. They want you to follow them and email them and give them business. Mm. And there are people who show up because they want a standing ovation. But if you show up wanting nothing, if you show up wanting no approval, no business, nothing, you're here to give. People sense that. Like all of us as human animals are very, very highly attuned to whether someone's acting selfishly or selflessly. We can tell. Our survival depends on it, which is why we're really good at sussing it out. And so when we assess that someone on stage is selfishly driven, we'll take their information, and we may do a transaction with them, but we won't give them our love and our loyalty. Where when we can tell someone is showing up for us, that wants nothing from us, simply to give to us, selflessly, we're grateful, and we will in turn give them everything and express our gratitude. So rule number one of public speaking is show up to give. Ironically, being an introvert has helped me be a public speaker, because I am very uncomfortable holding court. I'm much more comfortable talking to somebody one-on-one. And so when I'm standing on a stage, I very often ask them to keep the lights up so I can see the people, because when all the lights are out and I can't see anything but dark, I feel like I'm this performer and it's very uncomfortable. And when I can see people, I can look at one person and I can give them an entire thought or an entire sentence. Then I look at one person, I can see them nodding, and I can give them an entire thought, an entire sentence. And the people who are sitting back with their arms crossed, I ignore them. I talk to my champions. I talk to the people who I can give them an entire thought, and they make me feel good because they encourage me, as opposed to getting scared because I'm disappointing someone. And so find your champions and talk to one person at a time. And the amazing thing is you connect with an audience much more powerfully when you connect with individuals in the audience.
Beautiful.
There you go. Two tips.
Number three out of five. CEOs. What are great CEOs differently to What are great CEOs do differently to average ones or worse?
Great CEOs understand that money is fuel, that it's not the end result, right? That yes, of course, profit is important, because if you don't have the money to keep the company going, then the company is no good at advancing the higher cause or the higher purpose of taking care of the people. Yeah. But when money is the purpose, that means everything else is secondary. So money is absolutely important, but it comes second, and I can prove it to you. If I was to say to you, because I've never met a CEO ever that tells me that their people aren't important, right? The problem is where in the pecking order. You know, I've sat in the audiences of so many CEO speeches where they say, our number one priority is growth. Our number two priority is shareholder value. Our number three priority is our customer. Our number four priority is our employee, right? And even if they say our customer's our number one priority, that means employees come number two. So I can prove it. What if I say to you, our number one priority is growth, and of course our people are important, because without our people, we won't achieve our financial goals. Or I say to you, our number one priority is our people. And if we take care of our people, of course we'll achieve all our financial goals. Which company would you rather work for?
B.
Exactly. In other words, the order matters. The order matters. Of course money's important. Of course it is. But there is an order, and the order matters. And the great CEOs understand that their responsibility is not the results. It's to take care of the people who are responsible for the results. And the rest takes care of itself.
Beautiful, beautiful. Innovation. In your book, you talk passionately about how innovation is absolutely essential. So one quote I absolutely love is, the only way to find out if it will work is simply to do it, right? So I'm guessing that might lead into... But tips on innovation.
So true innovation is solving a real problem. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should do something. We can add digital screens to everything and put motors in anything, but doesn't mean we should. Like, what problems are we solving? You know? And truly innovative ideas solve a real human problem, whether the people understand that it's there or not, right? And organizations that are advancing something bigger than themselves are the ones that are able to innovate outside their own industries. This is why Virgin can be in so many diverse industries, but those in those industries can't go into any of Virgin's businesses. You know, Virgin can go into mobile, but, you know, T-Mobile can't start an airline. How is that? That's because one has defined themselves by their product or their industry, and the other one has defined themselves by bringing something to a product or an industry. And I've harped on a lot about Apple, but it's the same thing. Every single one of their competitors is equally competent to make every single product that Apple makes. If Dell wants to make MP3 players, they can. But nobody wants to buy an MP3 player from Dell. It's because one defines themselves by their product, and one defines themselves by something else that they can bring to an industry or product. I call it the why. I call it the sense of purpose, cause, or belief. And innovation, fundamentally, is about bringing something to a product or industry, not trying to bring features and benefits. Features and benefits may be good, but I wouldn't call them innovative. They're just nice to haves.
Simon, I just want to say, on behalf of all the viewers watching, your teachings are almost spiritual in nature. You're just up there. And I just want to say thank you for sharing your motivation and your inspiration with us today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to our Leaders In podcast. For more insight and inspiration, visit leadersin.com or check out our social media channels.